In today's Nutrition and Life episode, I speak with sports nutritionist and RP strength coach Gerald Earnett. Gerald and I speak about how to know you are purchasing a high-quality protein source, if you need to supplement with electrolytes, and whether to incorporate refeeds and diet breaks in your weight loss phase or not. I hope you enjoy this episode, and please, if you like the show, subscribe and give us a rating, or take a screenshot and share the episode on your social media. Thank you so much, now on to my conversation with Gerald. Hello and welcome back to the Nutrition and Life podcast. My name is Lisa, I'm your host, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with sports dietitian and RP strength coach Gerald Earnett. Welcome to the show, Gerald.
Thank you so much, Lisa. I appreciate it. It's going to be exciting to be on here.
Yeah, I look forward to talking about all things nutrition coaching, what that really means, specific foods, maybe also some nutrition for military staff and so on, or powerlifting. But before we do, I would love to hear a little bit about you and how you got to where you are today in terms of your coaching and also your own training.
Sure. Yeah. For coaching. So I grew up kind of unhealthy and overweight. And it wasn't until after high school, I decided that I really wanted to make a change. And I kind of got fed up with, you know, being unhealthy and a little bit overweight and a little, you know, not so confident in myself. And so I really just started trying to research as much as I possibly can on research on my own when it comes to nutrition. And that led me to the path of becoming a dietitian, then went going to school for all that fun stuff. And I just really enjoy it. And I wanted to specialize in more of like the sports nutrition aspect of things. So helping more athletic populations, but then also general population people too, just eating better, getting healthy, and then incorporating exercise alongside of that. And then down the road, I got into working with the military through my education, and to help even more people, I decided I wanted to go on the online route too. So
amazing. Well, I love it that you're truly committed to spreading the love and the message of a healthier life. And of course, also in terms of performance and helping the military staff, I can imagine is super rewarding. That actually like brings me to one of the first things I did want to talk to you about, because your social media is great. You share a lot of very specific information about specific foods, like beef, chicken, and so on. And we can talk about these individually in a moment. But one thing you also spoke about was electrolytes. And I think that's often really, difficult topic, because some people promote, you know, whatever supplement sticks or so, very overpriced. We want to take like, oh, take 2-3 per day. One of them is only, you know, $2. Is that really necessary? Or can we just have salt? Can we make our own electrolyte supplements? Is that even needed for all of us who maybe don't even much? So I would love to hear your take on like a general recommendation when it comes to electrolyte supplementation, yes or no, or what the stance is.
Absolutely. Yeah. So for like the general, like normal, like healthy person, you typically are not going to need electrolytes as long as you are, you know, having a variety of foods into your life that have all of those electrolytes anyways. But if you're more of an athletic population, if you're sweating a lot more, you are, you know, working out strenuously, electrolytes are probably a good idea for you. And they really aren't going to have like much of a negative consequence with them, especially if you're super duper active and sweating a lot. You need those electrolytes in your life for proper muscle function and recovery, and to make sure everything's working properly in your body. So, the main drawback of, you know, buying a powder or a potion or something like that is, you know, the cost. And so there's a lot of really fancy ones out there that cost an arm and a leg, but a lot of people can just get by with like a Gatorade powder that you can get really anywhere. There are some other specialty ones out there too. There's zero sugar ones, which may have a time and a place for some people, but typically an electrolyte, you want to have, you know, the main one, electrolyte mix or a powder, you want to have those, you know, sodium, potassium, but then also some carbohydrates alongside of that, especially if you are some sort of athletic population.
So the carbohydrate content helps shuffle that into the cells, or what's the reasoning behind that?
So one, it's just going to help with like absorption and help those electrolytes go where they're supposed to go. But then two, also, if you are exercising while you're doing that, carbs are your best friend. So kind of a double-edged sword there for you.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. And I think just that notion of like individualizing the recommendation to the specific person. For example, I'm someone, I don't really sweat a lot at all. Like even here, I live in a very humid, warm place. I don't really remember the last time I was drenched. And then I know other people, they walk up a flight of stairs and they're like sweating like crazy
Absolutely, yeah.
in the midst of winter, and I'm like, how does that even happen? But obviously someone like that and I, we have very different requirements when it comes to hydration and therefore also electrolytes. And I could imagine specifically also in the army, people that are stationed somewhere where it's really hot or they wear a lot of gear, they move a lot, that they probably do need some electrolyte supplementation. But
Absolutely.
I
Yeah,
just
there's a.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh no, I'm sorry. I was just gonna say there's a really cool like study on soldiers for like sodium depletion, and soldiers in like their full uniform in hot environments can lose up to like 5 to 6 grams of sodium through sweat losses in a day. That's grams. That's not milligrams.
Yes.
So that's a lot. So that's of course like kind of that high end. But that's a lot throughout the day. And if you're not replenishing your body with proper fluids and electrolytes, you can see some negative consequences. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I mean, you mentioned the most important one there is sodium. I think it's so easy to increase your own sodium intake without having to spend so much money on super fancy supplement sticks or so. So like even just salting your meals properly, especially as an athlete, or mixing a little bit of salt into your, I don't know if you're taking like EAAs or whatever, mixing that in there. I think that can often be sufficient without having to, like you said, spend an arm and a leg on these kind of supplements. And of course, we want to make sure we're also consuming potassium and some of the others. But for sure, I think that's a really good point just to kind of maybe adapt that to where you are at the moment in terms of your sweating or what season within the year it is and going from there. So yeah, thank you for sharing your take on that. And then going back to what I was saying earlier about your great post when it comes to more specific foods, one thing I thought was really interesting was in regards to hormones in meats, specifically in chicken. So I believe your post kind of said that actually within the US, they don't add hormones to chicken breast or something like that. Is that correct?
Yeah, so there's a lot of laws and regulations on especially like chicken and beef and more of those animal-based foods. And for the guidelines in the United States, it is illegal. We're not allowed to give hormones to chickens. Now, beef, that's another scenario. Beef, you can provide some of those hormones to them for like growth and reproduction and all that fun stuff. But for chicken, no.
Okay, well, yeah, that was actually very surprising to me for me to read because I mean, I live outside of the US, so I'm not too sure about it anyway. But generally speaking, you often hear that, in my opinion, like, oh, you need to buy organic in any case because otherwise it's loaded with hormones. So I thought that that was actually not that there's anything wrong with buying things organic if you can afford it in any case, but still, I think to the person that's super budget oriented, it's a good reason to still feel somewhat okay buying chicken breast that's not organic.
And I think a common argument that I see people throw out is like, oh, well, this chicken breast is just massive. How can this be possible? And that's more likely because of how they're being raised. A lot of times when they are mass producing, chicken or beef or anything like that, chickens especially, like they're crammed in a little cage, they don't have any movement, and they're just kind of like fed. And just like humans, if we don't move at all, we don't have access to the outdoors, we don't exercise, we don't do all of those good healthy things that we preach as coaches and healthcare providers all the time. Yeah, of course. And we just eat all day long. we're going to be larger individuals. So kind of the same thing with like chickens. When you get into like farming where they're able to move around, yeah, there's going to be some differences in like the size, but then also like potentially even nutrient composition and all that fun stuff.
Right. Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And going back to what you were saying about the beef. So beef. Tell us, is that usually if we buy conventional, is that being fed with or injected with some hormones, or how can we purchase a high quality beef source?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's tough because it's kind of a crapshoot. You don't really know what's happening to your animal products when you are purchasing them. But really the best thing that we can do is go to the source. So if you like shopping local, you want to support local farmers, which I highly recommend. Absolutely. And any sort of farmer that is completely transparent will gladly have you come on their ranch or farm or whatever and show you how they do things. Huge red flag would be, hey, call up your local farmer that you're getting your steaks from, be like, can I come take a look? I just want to see how everything's being done, and they turn you down. That's kind of a red flag in my opinion. So most farmers are more than happy to show you how they do things, and that's typically a good sign for you to like get a better indication of how they're going about raising and providing nutrition, but then also any sort of like pharmacology for breeding purposes.
Yeah, and I think it's a great idea to shop local to support your local farmers as well. My sister, my family, they live in Germany, and there you can actually buy like half a cow or a quarter of a cow. It's a little bit morbid because you still like you receive the name of the cow from when it was alive, and they send you like a picture. And yeah, that's it is a little bit morbid. And then after a while they're like, oh, it is the season, so yeah, here you go, here's your quarter of a cow, and you put that in your chest freezer. But at least you know
Absolutely.
like each part, and it's labeled, and you know where it's come from, what kind of life it had, and you know it had a very, very good life. So I do think that's a really great idea to you it, if you buy it in bulk, it's also reasonably cost friendly that way.
I'm a son of a beef cattle farmer, so I understand how that kind of goes. And it's tough sometimes. You can get a little attached to certain cows and cattle, but it's kind of the circle of life. But yeah, it can be really cost effective to get half or a quarter of a cow, and if you have a big old chest freezer, then that's a really reasonable way to make sure you get in your protein and you're not, spending an arm and a leg every time you go to the grocery store every week.
For sure. Yeah, and I think another food source that a lot of people often have question marks on is eggs, because it's like this one is cage free, this one is free range. What are really the differences? So what should we be looking out for when it comes to those labels?
So this might be a hot take, but I typically don't really look at those cage-free, free-range types of labels. I think they're more of like marketing terms than anything, because cage-free means that you can typically just have like access to the outdoors. So that just might be that, hey, they're in a barn or something, and there's a door or a window to that barn. So they have potential to go outside, but that doesn't mean they are going outside and walking around and stuff like that. So again, it just kind of all the common denominator is, hey, if you really want to know how your chickens or your beef are being raised and treated, going to a source is going to be the best way of going about that.
Yeah, again, I like the recommendation. And even there, like, I think if people go or get into the habit of going to a farmer's market or so, yes, at first, I think it often seems a lot more expensive, but maybe you can find that one person that you go to every week, and then they will get to know you, and they might be like, hey, Lisa, I know you're getting eggs every single week. Here you go. You can take a thing of 30, and I'll give it to you for cheaper or something. Like establishing those connections, I think in the long run, it goes a really long way.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, eggs are a tough one nowadays. They're like $8 for a dozen or something where I'm at right now, which is just, it's dreadful for us that are really focused on protein.
Yes, that's a very good point. But yeah, I mean, speaking of that versus packaged things, I also know that you speak about like food labels and so on. And sometimes I've seen that with my clients, at least, as a little bit of a source of inaccuracy with their tracking, or you know, they might hit a weight loss plateau, and after a while, we kind of dig through their food log and we kind of see, okay, a lot of the things you're scanning are packaged, and maybe that's where we're missing some calories. Talk to us about food label accuracy and how reliable they really are.
Yeah, so they for food labels, it's tough. I believe they can be up to about 20% inaccurate from some, recent findings, or they might not even be so recent. But yeah, there's always going to be kind of like ballparks rather than this is exactly the calorie and macronutrient content of this food. It's how they're cooked, how they're processed. There's so many other factors that go into it, but really, the best thing that I recommend for my clients is just try and be consistent as possible with your food sources. And nine times out of 10, that sorts out the tracking errors or the progress plateaus that we tend to see.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point because if we constantly have something else or always mixing things up too much and kind of playing the guesstimating game a little bit too much, that tends to be for sure a so potential source anyway of food errors or just mislabeling errors as well. So yeah, I think that's a very good point for just being more consistent. And I mean, truth be told, it also takes away some of the food thoughts that we have, some of the, oh, I have to reinvent the wheel every single day and think about what I crave or so.
I'm a creature of habit, so I especially like during the week, during work and like online coaching and everything, I have a busy to busy week typically. And so like I am perfectly content, and it actually kind of eases that like food anxiety or like stress or frustration out of my life to just have pretty much similar meals, at least a couple similar meals throughout the day and the week, just because then it's more streamlined. I don't even have to worry about it. I know what I need for my needs and my goals, and I'm good. And also, I think it's super individualized, like with what type of client that I'm working with too. So if someone's focused on fat loss, yeah, it's keeping it simple. Not ha like switching it up every single day or every single meal, it's probably going to make things just much more tolerable for you than someone that is, bulking. They can get a little bit more creative. They can err on maybe a little bit more of those deviations throughout the day, because we don't need to be as like restrictive with our calories or our nutrition.
For sure, that's a very good point in terms of nutritional periodization. And yeah, we were talking about weight loss plateau just a minute ago. And with that, my question sort of comes up in terms of refeeds and diet breaks. Is that something that you incorporate with your clients? And if so, when or which one, why sort of thing?
So I actually wrote an article for RP on refeeds and diet breaks not too long ago. But yeah, I do incorporate them with clients. It's really individualized. Some people, I have had clients that have dieted down and, lost a significant amount of weight without a single refeed or diet break. I've had other people that we've done them every 4 weeks too, of diet breaks, maybe even a little bit more frequently than that. I mean refeeds, sorry, I'm getting all switched up here. So it really is individualized from person to person, and how they react to a calorie deficit and a fat loss phase too. I've had some people where it's like, I feel good, I'm not hungry, I have no issues, I'm smashing the weights in the gym, I'm feeling good. If it ain't broke, we don't need to fix anything. We don't need to throw in another variable that could just, gunk things up or cause more issues. For some people, it's a little bit tougher. So I like to take a little bit more conservative approach with their dieting. And if that means that they have to do a diet break every 4 weeks or 5 weeks or 6 weeks, whatever it is, so be it. And I treat it just kind of like hitting the pause button on dieting. Sometimes we need that physical break. We need a little bit more food, especially those fun carbs for performance and recovery purposes. But then also, there's some really beneficial psychological benefits of diet breaks. Refeeds are a little bit more short term. So those can be especially helpful for people that are dieting pretty heavily or hard, and they need a little bit of a bump to push past some plateaus, maybe give you a little bit more of a relief, but then help with the performance for the following week.
I think the individualization part once again is so key. Like I'm someone I love just having steady calories basically all week long. I don't care. I don't want to do the mental math for myself of like increasing over the weekend or not. But then I have other clients where if I told them they need to eat the same amount on the weekends as during the week, they would be like, "What? But I want to go out," and it helps me with adherence and having a social life and not feeling so deprived during. So I think it's very important. And to the point of diet breaks, same thing. I think sometimes if we right in the beginning want to create a periodization and be like, "Oh, on week 12, we're going to take a diet break." I don't think that that's always a good idea. Yes, I like the notion of giving your client an idea what's coming up or something to look forward to if they are kind of afraid of the duration. But I think at the same time, like you mentioned, if you're on a good roll, sometimes just breaking that roll because it's scheduled to have a diet break. It can actually interrupt the flow. And then afterwards, I've seen it a couple of times where it was really hard for the client to get back into the dieting mindset. They've kind of like had a little taste of what quote unquote freedom feels like. And then they're like, "Oh no, I don't want to go back to eating a lot less." So I think again, it needs to be taken on an individual basis. And on the flip side, if someone What if you weren't planning to do a diet break with someone and you get to week 9 and they're like, "Oh, I'm really struggling. I have so much stress at work and I am not really sleeping well at the moment," and so on. And then like, "Okay, cool. Let's take a diet break. It wasn't planned. That's okay."
Yeah, like life is going to throw curveballs at us. And so I like to treat especially diet breaks as more reactive than proactive.
That's right.
It's one of those things too that you can have the most perfectly planned out nutrition or training program, but sometimes other things are going to get in the way, and we're not robots. We don't just stick to our diets and our training program and not worry about anything else in our lives. And so, yeah, I like to be a little bit more on the reactive side. And, if there's, there might be a time or two that I've been a little bit more proactive with diet breaks, but most of the time it's like, okay, I'm noticing trends from week to week with these clients. All right, it seems like now we need a little bit of a break to just kind of wash away all of the training and nutrition stress and fatigue that we've accumulated over the past month or two.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know what it's like with your training clients, but I personally like to go about my own training in the same way when it comes to deloads. So I auto-regulate my deloads. I know that there was a while where everyone was saying, "Oh, you need to like pre-schedule your deloads," and now it's kind of more like, no, auto-regulation is absolutely fine. And I could imagine that with performance athletes, it might be a little bit better to schedule that ahead of time or to work that into your larger cycles. But yeah, generally speaking, I'm interested, is that something that you implement with everyone, like a scheduled deload or more like kind of auto-regulation?
Yeah, I auto-regulation just like diet breaks for me. Again, like you can have a tentative plan, but everybody just reacts to training differently too. I've done, training cycles before where I didn't take a deload for 11 weeks. before. I was definitely needing one after that, but I wasn't showing any signs or symptoms. So again, why try and throw one in when I'm feeling good and want to just keep the ball rolling? Nowadays, I feel like I need deloads a lot more frequently for whatever reason. I don't know. I don't know if it was once I hit 30 years old, it's your body's just like, hey, no, we need more break or rest. I have no idea, but I'm sure it changes over time too. And as we get older, we might need more frequent deloads too, just with, training, recoverability, all of that.
Yeah, and I think there's something to be said about autoregulation in general because it just helps us stay more in tune with our actual body as opposed to just relying on the schedule or the data. And I mean, as great as data is, I love data just as the next person. And nowadays with like Oura Rings and Whoop and whatever, we have access to so much data that it's sometimes easy to disconnect from our body and how we're actually feeling on that day, especially if it's the first thing that you do in the morning. You look at your aura and you're like, oh no, I slept terribly, even though you actually slept. But yeah, so sometimes I think it can actually mess with our heads in the negative way if we're too con disconnected.
Yeah, definitely hyper focusing on things. And I've seen people talk about like your Oura Ring says that you got terrible sleep, but you feel great. Which one are you going to rely on more, right? Science and all this fun technology is amazing, but at the end of the day, I think it's best just to like really focus on how you're feeling and go from there.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of your athletes, I know you're sort of in the powerlifting space as well. So with performance athletes, is there anything in particular that you change or do differently when it comes to the nutrition, as opposed to for someone like Gen Pop, let's say? Yeah, I don't know any kind of specifics.
Yeah, for I would say not even like powerlifting specific, but like athlete specific. I would say nutrition wise, the main thing I might be a little bit more focused on are carbohydrates. So having a bit more of a bias towards carbohydrates than more general population people. When it comes to Gen Pop, I'm focused on just what we can be consistent and sustainable with when it comes to diet. If you prefer a little bit more fats in your life, cool. I like to have little guardrails and have it within some healthy ranges, but definitely more flexible with more of the general population people that just want to, eat a little bit healthier and feel good. For athletes, I think the guardrails might be just a little tiny bit tighter, and that's just because we want to ensure we are fueling for performance, but then also helping aid in that recovery process after workouts or in between multiple sessions throughout the day too, if they're having those.
And would you say that sort of applies for the nutrition for like military staff as well, or what do you do specifically or differently with military staff?
Yeah, military staff I treat more like athletes than anything, because most of them are training in the morning during physical training, and a lot of them are training on their own after words too. That could be during their lunchtime, or it could be after their regular workday at like 5, 6 p.m. for the things that they actually enjoy doing. So they might do their, unit PT in the morning, and that could be a range of things. It could be going on a run. It could be doing just a little cardio circuit. It could be lifting, what have you. But then maybe there's, I've had soldiers before that are like endurance athletes, and they go run 12 miles before they do PT. Or we have other ones that more of like the bodybuilder bros, and after work at 5 p.m., they're going to smash legs at the rec center down the road. So yeah, it's definitely more of that athlete focused. We have some people, some soldiers, they just do their PT, they get after it during that time in the morning, and they're perfectly content with that too. But definitely a broad spectrum from the soldier population that I work with.
Awesome. Yeah. And speaking of leg training, you also provide some great content on that. For example, when it comes to the bar placement on a squat, I think that's something of a question mark for some people sometimes when they're like, should I be trying to do a low bar squat even though I'm not a power lifter, or should I always have a high bar squat? What's kind of like the differences between the positionings there and even maybe foot placement as well?
Yeah, for most people, typically there's two, like high bar or low bar, and high bar is a little bit higher up on your traps. Low bar is a little bit more rested on your rear delts than anything. And with high bar, for most people, it allows for them to remain more of an upright torso, allows for your quads to go over and like stretch your quads out and go over your toes a little bit more. And and then as far as low bar goes, that places the bar further down on your back, makes your torso typically lean a little bit more, some more than others, and has a little bit more of an emphasis on your posterior chain then too. For if people are just trying to be healthy, get in a squat pattern throughout the week, then I say dealer's choice typically. Whatever feels comfortable for you, go with that. Most people, if they're focused on strength, would likely benefit from more of a low bar position, but there's always outliers in that too. I've seen plenty of high-end powerlifters that place that bar as high as they can go, and they're squatting 800, 900 pounds. So really individualized based on like your limb lengths and your torso and your biomechanics and everything and what just feels good and where you feel strongest at. But those are kind of like the general starting points that I go towards with my training clients.
Yeah, and I think they both have, like you say, advantages, also in the sense of what kind of range, where we're working the range of motion more or less. So, like if someone says they really want to improve their ankle mobility and quad strength, then, obviously, like something like a high bar squat is probably going to be better to work towards. But as you mentioned, if someone is really like numbers focused and just wants to lift as heavy as possible, and has really strong hamstrings, then why not do a low bar squat, for sure. So yeah, really good point to kind of think about what is my actual target. And my personal question, because I'm always like someone thinking about glute development and so on also, is there any research that says one is better than the other for glute development per se, or is that also like anatomy dependent?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of anatomy dependent, but you're going to work your glutes in both of them. I'm not sure about if you're going to get a bigger bang for your buck. I'm safe to, say like absolutely this one's going to be better for you. They're both going to work your glutes. If I were a betting man, I might place a little bit more on that low bar to get a little bit more glute activation, but it's really going to be dependent on person. So
Right.
I'm not very comfortable saying like, yeah, absolutely this one. But yeah.
Probably largely depends on range of motion with either one as well, I guess.
I think, the person that I would go to for a question like that would be like Brett Contreras
Right.
for like glute activation.
Yeah, I'm aware of a somewhat recent study where they're talking about like hip thrusts versus squats and maybe even deadlifts, and I don't remember specifically where they're comparing those differences, but to my knowledge, they did not include whether the squat in that study was specific to high or low bar. It was just specific to, are they breaking
Are
sort
they
of the
doing a squat pattern?
Exactly. But I mean, similar sort of movement, but something that not as many people nowadays, anyway, practice or emphasize so much is the leg press. And I believe you're also an advocate of doing or incorporating the leg press in your training program. I think now that people have really focused on shifting or shifted towards focusing on functional training, sometimes they only squat and they don't leg press anymore. So what are some reasons why we could or should incorporate the leg press as well?
Yeah, I've been loving the leg press personally for myself. lately, and that's just because it takes a lot of stress and strain off my back and my spine. It's been really fun for myself to just go in and smash my legs and, get a good leg workout, but then not feel like an old man and I'm walking like this with my back after, low bar squatting, a lot more weight. And yeah, I feel strong, but that recoverability is a huge aspect, and the fatigue that is associated with putting a barbell on your back just needs to be considered. Not to say one's superior than the other, of course, but yeah, I think both can definitely be placed in a program throughout the week too. So you could get the best of both worlds with more of the quote unquote like functional training of a barbell back squat, but you're still going to be working those muscles in a leg press, and it can be a little bit more user friendly, especially from like a fatigue perspective too.
Right. Yeah, I think that makes again makes a lot of sense because the back squat or heavy back squatting in particular, that does pose quite the big stressor, good and bad, on our spinal load. So let's say someone, like just general population client, has 3 days for training, about an hour each time, and they're including the squat, they're also including leg press, and they ideally would like to achieve some hypertrophy, but they do have a very stressful life and so on. What would be, I don't know, some other 5 to 10 exercises that you would definitely include in their program?
Oh gosh, this is fun. Are we just talking about just overall strength and
Just
hypertrophy
overall.
then?
Yes.
Okay, so they got a squat and they got a leg press. I think some sort of like pushing movement. I'm a big fan of like dumbbells just because it's a little bit more user friendly, and a barbell is a little bit more of a fixed position, and typically, if you're kind of just getting into the gym, might be a little bit more user friendly, a little bit easier on your joints than like a barbell for like the pushing movements in the shoulders. So some sort of like pushing movement. It could be a machine, it could be dumbbells, it could really be whatever you would like. I like something like overhead too for shoulders and pushing. That's going to be quote unquote a little bit more functional too, right? Let me think here. Pull-ups. Can't go wrong with some pull-ups, right? And get a strong back. You could do some rows as well to hit your back. Some sort of hinge movement. So RDLs, deadlifts. I like carries too. So like a Zercher carry or a sandbag carry or farmer's carries. Those would definitely be great for just overall strength and have some function to them, especially if your team no second trip to from the grocery store, right? With all your bags.
I think that's a those are very underrated exercises, the carries, because I believe our grip strength is highly correlated with how long we live as well, like in the sense of how, as you mentioned, self-sufficient we can stay during our years of aging. So yeah, any kind of carry, I think that's a great idea, especially if we only have 3 training sessions per week. And I mean, pull-ups are great, but many people even struggle with pull-ups or with deadlifts because they cannot, like, their grip strength is giving out.
Yeah, absolutely. And with those two, I say like, hey, throw some straps on. There's nothing wrong with that. Like you can do more direct grip work too. But you can get best of both worlds. So if you're getting heavier and heavier on your deadlifts or whatever, and your grip starts giving out, like, hey, those warm-up sets and stuff, you're still working on them, and maybe you throw some other grip strength exercises in there. But there's no shame in throwing some straps on too to make that a little bit easier, and you can actually work those target muscles that you're trying to grow and get stronger.
Yeah, I love these nice, not wrist straps. Yeah, grips, for sure. I used to almost only try to do my hook grip. So for the people listening who don't know what that is, basically you're squashing your thumb, but it helps you. It helps you hold on to the bar a little bit easier. And yeah, I thought that was very, very helpful. Also, I'm not a big fan of for just re regular training purposes of doing alternating grip, just because I find that most people, they kind of twist one way rather than the other, and or they They find they have one favorite side, and then they only do that one side, and it's kind of like lopsided. So I don't, for Gen Pop, I don't really like that too much. But yeah, using some grips or the hook grip, I think that that's for sure a good way to increase your weight while working on your grip strength.
Yeah, the hook grip is not for the faint of heart. I've done it plenty of times. I've competed in some Scottish Highland Games competitions too, and with those throwing events, you really have to do a hook grip, or else you're not gonna, be too successful. And yeah, it's a different ball game when you start incorporating those.
To continue on with the exercises, is there any specific core work that you would recommend, or do you believe the compounds are kind of enough, given that the person has a limited amount of time?
I think compounds are great, but you can't go wrong with some direct like core work too. Those carries can be really helpful with that as well. Even like heavy squats and deadlifts and stuff like that are obviously going to have some core activation and work in there too. But as far as like direct work goes, I mean, you can get by with like just a few simple exercises throughout the week. Maybe you do like a hanging leg raise one day, you do a cable crunch another day, and one that I really like are kind of they're called banded dead bugs. So you lie on your back, you hold the band with your arms, and then you raise your legs. Those light me up every single time. Doesn't matter how often I do them, they do the job for sure.
I think even without the band, some people really struggle with that, and it cracks me up every time, because those sometimes are the same people that want to deadlift, I don't know, 200 and whatever pounds, and then they can't or don't want to hold a dead bug for a minute. And it's like, well, we could really work that also while doing deadlift, not while, but at the same time while working on deadlift. It's such a great foundational core exercise that can be challenging at any level.
For sure.
Well, Gerald, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure speaking with you and just picking your brain on various food sources and training in general. I will make sure to obviously link your social handles in the show notes so people can go and check out your content and continue to learn from you or see what your coaching is like. But yeah, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
No problem. It's been fun. I really appreciate you having me hop on here and chat about some nutrition and training stuff.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Gerald. Thank you so much for tuning in. Go and give us both a follow on Instagram or YouTube. One more thing before you go, if you are looking for premium supplements, our partner Fat Muscle Project has got you covered. Head to their website for the best protein powders, creatine, vitamin D, and more, and feel free to use our code NCL at the checkout. Thank you for listening, and don't forget, life is too short to be in a body you don't feel good in.